Well, good evening. A bit of an explanation. That was a video created by Vincent specifically for his show upstairs. It's playing on a continuous loop in the gallery, so if you would like to see it again, he specifically asked that we show it before we all do our talking head things this evening. And I think the reasons why he wanted to show that first will become apparent during his talk. Good evening. My name is Lyle Williams. I'm the curator of prints and drawings and the curator of America's Finest, recent works by Vincent Valdez. Before I have the pleasure of introducing Vincent this evening, a couple of notes I need to take care of beforehand. To paraphrase Hillary Clinton, it takes a village to put an exhibition on. And so we're most thankful to our lead sponsors, the Arthur and Jane Stearin Fund for Exhibitions. Additional sponsors are the Liberto family, Amy and Chase Smiley, Samantha and Jerry Gore, the Director Circle, and the Host Committee. And I know some of these people are here, so please join me in a round of applause, thanking them for their support. So our plan is, and we'll try to stick to it. After my introduction, Vincent will speak. And then there will be another short film produced by Wally Films, and we're very happy that Mark and Angela Wally are here this evening with us. And then at the very end, there will be a quick question and answer session. So that's all the housekeeping. So Vincent Valdez, as many of you know, was born here in San Antonio in 1977. At a very early age, he showed a propensity for drawing, a talent that was encouraged by his family. He studied very early on with a great friend, Alex Rubio, and worked on murals with Alex downtown. Eventually, Vincent would create murals at his alma mater, Burbank High School, on the South Side. Vincent eventually left San Antonio to study art and received his bachelor's degree from the Rhode Island School of Design. I met him shortly thereafter, after his return to San Antonio from RISD. And Vincent and I were talking the other day, and we both were shocked at the fact that it's been over 10 years. I met him because I was putting together an exhibition of contemporary drawings here at the McNay. And my method of putting that show together was I had a handful of artists whom I wanted to include. And after I had chosen drawings from these different artists, I asked them, who else should I go and look at? And half of the artists that year said, you have to go see Vincent Valdez. And the second I walked into his studio, not only did I know that a work of his would be included in that survey, but he had worked on some very large-scale charcoal drawings, and I also knew in seconds of seeing the work that I would have to do a show for him as well. And so that show came to fruition in 2004. It was called The Stations. Some of you may remember it. In 2004, at that time, Vincent was the youngest person ever to have a solo exhibition at the McNay. I had a very similar experience very recently when I visited Vincent's studio about 2 years ago, and he was working on a painting that you'll see called John, and this is a 96-inch wide oil on canvas. It's a knockout. Some of you may not know, but I've actually been taking painting classes with Vincent, so even if I don't become a great painter, what I am learning is how great other people are at painting, and this is a great painting. So having said all of that, invite Vincent up to the podium. Welcome Vincent back to the McNay.
All right, good evening. I'd like to start off by thanking each one of you for being here tonight. It's always a continuous honor and privilege to be here at the McNay to share my work and vision with the McNay and all of its great audiences that I have been able to interact with over the past 10 years or so. I was really excited about this evening for a number of different reasons. Number one, because it meant I was finally done with the show and I was a free man again. Number two, I really wanted to try something different in this presentation of slides. Instead of just sort of standing up here and talking directly about the exhibit that you see in America's Finest upstairs, I wanted to try to take a different approach and sort of put together an almost a chronological timeline, because I think it's necessary and important to sort of emphasize that I didn't just sort of wake up one morning and try to figure out a subject matter to portray in my work and think, oh, why not soldiers and boxers? You know, it sounds cool. I mean, this has literally been a lifetime spent at this point of just sort of thinking about these concepts and sort of branching them out into various other concepts and reevaluating them and experimenting with these things, analyzing these things. It's endless, you know, as a painter in the studio. And I can't believe that I have literally spent 35 years now almost literally working, doing the same thing that I was doing at 3 years old. I made a joke a few weeks ago that I thought for sure at this point I would have found a more legitimate career by now, but I guess not. You know, I always have a running joke with my friend Chris Davila that I should have been a shoe salesman. But no, all kidding aside, I wouldn't trade this for anything in the world. I think I was fortunate enough to understand and embrace at a very early age that I had a rare opportunity to say something. And I think that this exhibition for me is really kind of not only the strongest exhibition that I've executed at this point in my career, but it's also probably the most personally connected to me. So with that being said, I'll start breezing through these images. And I thought I'd start with this image here. This is my most recent, latest work in the studio. Finished it last night. Just kidding. I rehearsed that one all week. This is probably one of my earliest drawings. If it wasn't for my mother keeping all of these things in her closets and in boxes, she's my number one archivist. All of these things were probably and should have been disappeared by now. But the reason I decided to show this image, this early image, was because there's something that struck me when I found this a few years ago. Already there was this inclination to sort of portray the underdog, the outsiders, the idea of those sort of left behind or forgotten entirely, or those that, like the little black fish there, they're trying to find their own way and make their own paths in the world. I would say at an extremely early age, I encountered my first museum, and it was the little tiny Southside home of my grandparents. And their entire house was like a small mini museum in the Southside community with the works of my great-grandfather, who was a painter, a man that I never met, a man that is more sharply dressed than anyone else that I knew or have seen in photos, and I hear that he actually looked like that in the studio. And so all of his paintings were on exhibit in my grandparents' house. I remember very vividly sitting in this dark hallway and looking up at this small oil painting that he did, probably as a young man. It's dated 1884. 1888, somewhere around there. It's a beautiful piece. But this image for me, I remember staring up at it just in a gaze, in complete awe. And I couldn't understand it. It was a very violent, striking image. And I realized at that moment, you know, I literally remember staring at this piece and saying, I want to do that. There's something that was so haunting and something that was so evocative about this image. He was a great painter. Over the years, my grandparents have started to hand down some of these paintings to me. I cherish these paintings not only because they're by my great-grandfather, but because I see a lot of the similarities. I see, you know, it must be in the genes. There's these sorts of various viewpoints and takes on society, on culture, on social issues. Now, also at that young of an age, I encountered the stories from my grandfather and from my father about their experiences as young men at war. You know, and at that point, you know, age four, age five, like most other boys, you know, there was this real fascination with soldiers and Superman, superheroes. But I remember going into my grandparents' house, and my grandpa always had this treasure chest that was like the most interesting, surreal object that I had ever seen. I remember it smelled like wet mildew or wet blankets. but he always would pull out this old leather, it's almost deteriorated, old scrap photo book from World War II. When he was a young man, he would tell me these stories about how he was a bubble gunner underneath, a turret gunner underneath the B-17s, and how he knew he wouldn't make it out alive, and so he had to come up with a plan B. I remember very clearly the stories of my father telling me that what his experience was like when he walked home from Handy Andy, his high school job or his after school job, and he received his draft notice in 1969, I believe. And this was sort of kind of an epiphany for me because, again, at age 5, age 6, I should have been throwing rocks outside of my little brother or something, but I was more interested in, you know, very quickly in these sort of more complex stories that in my head were sort of, you know, there was all these questions. And I remember looking up to my dad and asking him as a kid, but why did you go? And he said, well, he responded, well, I had to. And I responded, but why? And he says, well, you just had to. That's something you had to do. And I continued, it was sort of like this ping pong table. We were going back and forth. And I remember asking him, but if you didn't want to go, why didn't you just not go? Who can make you do something? And he said, well, the government. You know, he said that was, you know, we were called, you had to serve. But it set off this whole trigger of a chain reaction in my head, you know, in my young head. And I immediately went in and started portraying some of these things in the drawings. And you can see the real shift, you know, probably from within a few years from like age 4 or 5 to about age, let's see here, 7 or 8. So from that to something like this, where, you know, around age 9, age 10, I was already trying to figure out and flesh out these stories. You know, it wasn't my own experiences, but it was the experiences of those closest to me. And I think that you can see the real shift of this idea from and of this analytical approach to what heroes are. So this idea of heroes such as these masculine heroes, these masculine icons, such as my grandfather here at 103 pounds with this million-dollar shot of him getting his front teeth knocked out, literally, barefoot, as a 17-year-old boy who lied about his age to serve in World War II, to images, like the one behind a young Alex and I, probably around 1989. Alex with that classic hairdo. I always got a rag on him for that. But there was already this very sort of complex approach, I think, on my part. You know, I was always asking these questions and sort of challenging these ideas and these notions of what mythologies and heroes were. And so when I first met Alex at the old Esperanza Peace and Justice Center, which is actually still standing, this mural, you know, the irony of my days as a muralist is that all of my murals that I did as a teenager up until my early 20s are completely, they're all gone. The only one that's ever survived is the very first one that I did, and that's in the picture, and that's standing right across the street from Chris Madrid's. And so Alex tells this story about when he met me, he saw the drawing ability that I had in my little school folder that I handed to him, and he gave me my own wall. Now, I had never picked up a paintbrush, and he gave me a quick demo, and I was like a sponge. I mean, I just absorbed everything, every piece of information that he gave me, and he left me alone, which was probably the most crucial, important thing that he could have done to me, especially as a young artist. I wanted to prove to him that I could do this. And so while most of the kids were painting happy faces and rainbows, the theme of the mural was world peace. Alex came back about 3 hours later, and I had painted this scene of people working in the fields, croppers, harvesting the fields. And in the sky, you see these silhouettes of these fighter jets that are swooping down on them, about to drop napalm. And then it reads in the sky, "Make food, not war." And in the actual text, you know, I thought it was pretty funny. I'll read a small excerpt. I'm quoted as saying, "When I grow up, will there still be mountains, animals, and food for the animals? Will we be able to see the sunrise if we start dropping bombs everywhere? Will there be people to see my stuff, mural? Will I be alive to see it?" So I was a weird kid. I mean, my parents, I don't know how they weren't terrified of about what the hell was going on and didn't send me to therapy. But so after that mural, Alex hired me on as his apprentice. And we did so many different projects in the housing projects around in the west side of San Antonio downtown, and it was golden. What a golden, invaluable education and experience like no other could ever come close, no other could ever top. Because for me, again, that exposure, that realization at an extremely early age that to have somebody in the flesh like Alex, where I was able to look at him, admire him, and say, that's where the bar is. That's what I want to do. I saw what he was capable of doing. And it sort of made me this terribly ambitious kid. You know, I was so set on just following in his footsteps. So as we would do these projects, like this one here that was at the Vietnam War Museum that used to be across the street from the Alamo, we spent one entire summer painting all of these war scenes from Vietnam. And Alex would get paid the cash, and my payment was that I would be able to sift through their all of their sort of equipment archives, and I would take home helmets and combat gear. And so by the time I was, you know, a young teenager, again, it was this sort of almost already obsession about this idea of immortals and you know, what it took to be a hero. But I think at this point it was still very much so a boyhood sort of fascination with this idea of heroism, warriors, the ultimate immortal for all of us, you know, Air Jordan in the sixth grade. You know, and so it was a very generic sort of stance and view on, still at this point, you know, of what these men were capable of. Now then something happened around 1990, it was this sort of second epiphany, this sort of wake-up call. And I'll never forget it, and for several different reasons. My dad took the family to go see Platoon, Oliver Stone's Platoon, one night. How my mom allowed him to do that, I have no idea. But I remember sitting in that movie theater and my mom reaching over and explaining to me, she said, "Mijo, if you need to close your eyes, feel free to close your eyes. You don't have to watch this." And little did she know, that complete opposite effect. I mean, my eyes were like wide open because I could not understand what could be so shocking that I would need to close my eyes. And so the movie progressed. You know, it was very brutal scenes of warfare and this sort of harsh reality. I mean, I think at that point, you know, it was criticized but it was also praised for being one of the first films in response to the Vietnam War of what it actually was like, in contrast to the John Wayne films, right? That sort of John Wayne personification of war. And the other thing that I realized during that film was I found myself halfway through the films staring at the audience more than I was the actual screen, because I had this sort of realization, this sort of, again, this sort of wake-up call. And I watched the audience intently, and I saw how they were in awe. It was complete silence, dead silence. And I thought, that's it. Like, that's what I need to do. That's what I want to do. The ability to capture an audience for more than 2 seconds, the ability to make an audience feel, you know, a wave of emotion, whether it's you know, laughter, sorrow, etc. And I felt like this moving image on this large scale was very much like murals, right, at that point. I felt like it was paintings that were in motion. And I saw this instant connection between the two. So I ran home, and it seemed like all of the small drawings that I was doing at that point just changed forever. You know, I was immediately engrossing myself in this idea of these harsh realities of these young men. And so people always ask me, you know, who my influences were, and I always say, well, not the dead guys. You know, I've never been too interested in collecting old books from Michelangelo and Caravaggio and, you know, the famous guys. I've always been, or even contemporary artists for that matter, I've always been extremely influenced by filmmakers, documentary photographers, and video games. And I feel like those are my instant connections to this work. So I had a book, or I found a book at the Collins Garden Public Library, probably in the fifth or sixth grade, and it was by this name I had never heard, a photographer named Larry Burroughs, who to me, to this day, you know, I completely hold up on a pedestal. To me, this guy had that eye. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to tap in not only to his subject but to his audience. And so this was a study of Larry Burroughs, a soldier at Khe Sanh. And then fast forwarding to 20 years later, you know, I did this drawing about a year ago titled After You, Larry. And it was my first and only homage and tribute and gratitude to Larry Burroughs, a study of one of his portraits. And so at this point at RISD, up in Rhode Island, I majored in illustration, and I thought that I wanted to do book covers and CD illustrations, stuff like that. But then I figured out very quickly I didn't like the idea of somebody dictating to me what my subject matters were going to be or what my color was going to be. So I sort of broke away from the department and just kind of did my own thing. And probably when I was entering my senior year, you know, it was this real change of pace for me. And I feel like from this point on, the work really rapidly evolved. It really just sort of took off, even beyond my own handling. And I always felt like from this point on, I was just sort of following it, and it was leading me into different directions and different paths and journeys. I was trying to figure out an image to portray for, or to produce for my final semester painting, you know, the exit before graduation. And I came across this old photograph that was one of the only few photographs that's known to exist of the night of the Zoot Suit Riots in Los Angeles in 1943. Now, it really struck a chord with me again because I read this article, and this information was just baffling to me. I couldn't understand how this could have been in America in the 20th century, you know, not that long ago. And in a nutshell, it was a very brutal and erased history, an erased piece of Los Angeles history and an erased piece of American history. And there was about 200 American servicemen who right on the brink of Pearl Harbor, right after Pearl Harbor, you know, there was a lot of hysteria. The Japanese Americans were being rounded up. Well, there was actually this sort of wave of intentional hysteria that was trying to be created in the city of Los Angeles towards Mexican Americans and the Zoot Suiters, Pachucos. We've all seen Cesar Martinez's paintings, you know, the flashy dressers with the hair, the Stacy Adams, the chains. You know, these guys took great pride in their clothes. And so there was about 200 American servicemen who marched in the streets of downtown Los Angeles and in East LA, armed with bats and clubs, chains and fists. And any Zoot Suiter that they came across, they stripped them naked, and you see the boy stripped naked, one with his coat thrown over his face, very violent image, and the other one, his friend, who's sort of sitting at his side. And the LAPD just sort of sat around and allowed it to happen. Any boy that hit a serviceman was automatically thrown in a paddy wagon and sent to jail. This lasted for 3 days before it was a full-blown race riot, and I knew immediately I had to do something in response to this piece of erased history. So this was the image that I came up with titled Kill the Pachuco Bastard, which was the chant of the servicemen as they marched into the streets. Now, this was literally the first piece of artwork in my career that I had produced that caused a lot of backlash, that received a lot of backlash, you know, not only from various communities, scholars, institutions even. And it couldn't have been better timing because 2001 had just occurred. 9/11 had just occurred about a year later after this was produced. And it was that same sort of sense of hysteria, you know, marketed hysteria, internal hysteria within the communities, within the cities, the nation, et cetera. So once I returned home from RISD, I sort of stayed on that path. You know, I allowed myself to just kind of step back and look at the world around me, and I allowed myself to respond to the world around me, you know, whether it was as a society, whether it was in my own backyard, in my community, in my family. All of the above was sort of a, you know, was a free-for-all. And so this was one of the earliest images that I created right after school titled, What's Your Profile? In response to racial profiling. Now, it was based off of, I felt, some of the profiling that was that I sort of encountered up in Providence, Rhode Island. You know, and again, being from Texas, we all know we literally are our own country. I mean, I thought the whole world was like Texas. I thought everybody ate tacos on Sunday for breakfast or even for at midnight, you know. breakfast tacos, that is. But it was a real sort of culture shock when I went up there. And so it was a very important experience because it was such a shift in the way that I saw things, in the way that I thought, and in the way that I analyzed and then fleshed out all of these ideas. Also, right around that time, 1999, some of you may remember or be familiar with the case of Amadou Diallo Jr., who was a Haitian or Jamaican immigrant in Brooklyn that was walking towards his apartment, was pulled over by about six or seven unmarked undercover officers, and then he was shot 42 times. Some of the officers even reloaded their clips and continued shooting. When they found what he was reaching for in his pocket, he was taking out his ID. And so that, you know, I think in overall these images, again, are all sort of very pivotal experiences for me, experiences in terms of the images that I see on television, the images that I encounter as an American, the images that I encounter as a Mexican-American. So I've always felt like my work is a real sort of dissection of all of these things sort of layered one on top of the other. A response to that piece a few years later titled, My Chances Really Were a Million to One. So I think the important thing to sort of recognize is as this work starts to evolve and really kind of pick up speed and branch out, these ideas sort of remain the same, but at the same time, there's such a obvious variation, whether it be technically through technique or medium, you know, everything from charcoal to pencil to oil to now the film formats and a few three-dimensional pieces. But also in terms of concepts, you know, I really strive as an artist to continuously challenge myself, to change things up, to reinvent myself. I mean, I think for me, reinvention is key as an artist because it's very easy to sort of forget and get comfortable with the subjects that you're used to and that you're good at. And so for me, it really is one of the few ways that I can keep myself entertained and challenged in the studio. Many of you may be familiar with this face, my younger brother Daniel, who will probably be more famous at this point than I ever will be. I've been at HEB with this guy, and cashiers ask for his autograph. So, you know, at the same time, I think that many of this work that takes on this sort of universal format. You know, it sort of embodies all of us at some point. But at the same time, I like that I'm able to keep it very specific. You know, I think that's something that's very difficult to do, at least it is for me, but I know it's possible. You know, there's always seems to be, especially in the art world, this real need and this real sort of obsession with categorization. Everything has to be labeled and placed in a box. Everyone has to fit in a certain format or a certain genre of art making. And I've always felt like I've always sort of run away from that as fast as I could. I'm constantly trying to elude any kind of pigeonholing. It's not an easy thing to do, and not in terms of figuring it out technically, but it's not easy to do in terms of the actual of fitting into the art world, because one of the reactions that I find is many of the art critics, curators, patrons even, don't really know many times how to address such confrontational work, such work that sort of pertains to a harsh reality, a real honesty to the work, but above all else, work that I think deems itself extremely personal. I find many times in the studio that it makes people uncomfortable, but I'm okay with that. You know, I think that as an artist, that's something that should be embraced. You know, I feel that many of this work for me eventually, or actually all of this work at some point at the end of my career or long after I'm gone, if one person gets it all back together and lays out a timeline, it not only will be a timeline of the world at this moment in time, but it becomes a timeline of a self-portrait. You know, each one of these faces are somebody that I've encountered. Each one of these experiences is something that's very close to me. This was a series titled Made Men that I did probably in 2002. These very large-scale pastels on paper. And this was a very important series for me because it really was sort of this very refined, polished breakthrough of pinpointing exactly what I wanted to say at this point. I felt like the technique was where I wanted it to be, and the concepts, the clear thinking, was where I needed it to be. This isn't the first time, upstairs isn't the first time that I've used a Bob Dylan lyric as inspiration for a series of works. This was a series of works based after the song I Shall Be Released. So each image takes a line from that song. They say every man must need protection. They say every man must fall. The third piece was, I swear I've seen my own reflection. And then the final piece was, any day now I shall be released. And so it was this idea of the epitome of these masculine icons. It was the modern street kid who's trying to find his way or break his way out of the chain link fences. Perhaps he's imprisoned, incarcerated. Perhaps he's breaking his way out, finding his way out of his small community. And he's sort of reflecting back on those young males who have come before him, who have been persecuted before him, who have been shunned before him, and who have been erased before him. And so he's trying to figure out what pair of shoes to fill. So whether you interpret it as him having endless or many options or no options is up to the audience. This was probably the first time that I sort of made this connection. I started calling these characters my Frankenstein men, because like Frankenstein, we all know him as this sort of creature, this mysterious creature, who was this sort of fascinating subject. You know, everybody wanted to sort of know, touch him or see what he was like. He was very alien. But the idea of him being created by society, him being used by society for their entertainment, and then him being shunned by society and discarded when they were done with him, each one of these men were Frankenstein, the modern Frankenstein. Fast forwarding a few years, around 2007, I moved to Los Angeles and wound up remaining there for a few years. For me, I felt it was another real stepping stone in my career with my work, because the work really started to shift at an even more rapid speed. This was a piece in 2008 titled Burn, Baby, Burn. It was a lot different from me. You know, I remember feeling or facing a lot of turmoil with my work in the studio. It was probably one of the first times in my career that I sort of felt, art freeze. You know, I couldn't see my way through, and I couldn't really work in the studio. You know, I was processing, I think at this point, everything was moving so fast with exhibitions and with the creation of this work constantly in the studio that everything came to a screeching halt. And one day I was looking out the view from my window, which was this view here, and I saw this vision. I saw the vision of moving to La La Land, you know, Hollywood, where all your dreams come true, and watching all of my hopes and dreams go up in flames. But at the same time, it was a very strong social political commentary for me. You know, I felt that the nation was facing great turmoil, you know, with the economy, with the wars. And so that's something that's very crucial in my work. It's always, again, you know, I'll keep emphasizing, it goes both ways for me. It's not enough to make it only a self-portrait, nor is it enough to make it only a socio-political commentary. And this is just a typical day at the park in Los Angeles. You know, it was a very exciting time for me. This city, this world, it was such a strange, chaotic place. You know, Los Angeles for me was this destination that always seemed to be hanging off the cliff. It always seemed to be teetering on the brink of chaos, whether it be earthquakes or fires, LAPD, gangs, I mean, you name it, it's there, Hollywood. And it was great for me. You know, it was really, I really got a lot out of it and saw a lot of things. And so after about 3 years there, then it started to flesh out. Seeing these things on television happening right down the street from where my studio was, actually being a part of some of these images or experiences, you know, was also a big key factor. And then the work started to really pour out, and I saw another real shift in the work. The work at this point was getting pretty monumental in scale. I was now thinking in terms of pinpointing even more my commentaries about the United States and this one exact moment in time. But I was realizing, looking back on the work that I had done previously to this, that I really relied a lot on history. You know, history for me was as crucial as the modern, as crucial as the present. And I was trying to blur the lines of the real and the non-real, the past and the present. And that sort of became key for me, and I decided to go down that path. By creating work through the use of realism, this sort of hyper-realism, I like the sense and the idea of confusing the audience, so much that they are actually convinced that I drew this from a photo because I was standing behind this horse that was about to trample me. Or opposite of that, the audience member feeling like it was completely invented out of my own wacky imagination. And that distortion for me really started to take on a real crucial role in the work. We all know both of these guys, the King of King William. And so I wanted to share this with you because you get a sense of how I'm staging these things like a movie director in the studio. For me, film, again, has always been an extremely important influence, and many times in staging these models in the studio, I feel like a movie director. Now, I think it's important to note that when I stand before the easel or the sheet of paper, I can vividly see each one of these concepts, each one of these invented fictitious narratives or characters or landscapes in full motion in my head. I can hear them. I can smell the way that landscape, you know, smells. I can hear the voices, the chanting, the backgrounds. And so they morph immediately from the staged into this whole other dimension. And again, I feel like I kept the monumental scale because those were the extensions from my days as a young muralist. As a muralist, I was able to realize that the captivation of a viewer driving down the freeway was some sort of spectacle like no other else. You know, it's one thing to hang something on a wall and have somebody pass by it in a museum setting, in a house, in an office. But to have somebody driving, to have an entire neighborhood view your work, I felt was really something that I was really obsessed with. And the work started getting larger and larger, and more dealers and framers started hating me because this stuff was almost impossible to frame. Some of them weighed up to 200 pounds with the glass. But, you know, I refused to compromise on the scale. This was a diptych titled Winner. So
you get that real sense of, at this point, I've sort of minimalized and shed away all the things that I felt I had been used to at that point. Extremely detailed landscapes, settings, backgrounds. And I minimalized, I completely discarded the figure from the neck down. And it was a real honing in and a repolishing of conveying the concepts. The concepts now, I felt, were probably at this point a little bit more important than the actual portrait. So it was really this interaction with you, the viewer. You almost were staring at him, at this David staring at Goliath. So it becomes this sort of three-way interaction. But if you blink like he blinks, you'll miss his 2 seconds of glory. He's beaten, he's tattered, he's torn. And he sort of faces his own uncertainty. He faces his own destinies, his own fates. He reflects on the society that's placed him on this pedestal. And perhaps he's questioning if the fight was fixed all along. Perhaps he's questioning whether it was worth it after all. In 2009, I was getting ready to move back to San Antonio. And up to this point, you know, the boxers were really kind of dominating the work. And I was sort of sizzling out on the boxers a little bit. I had done the station show here at the McNay. And I felt like I didn't want to give up the idea and the relationship I had with these masculine icons, these tragic male icons. And so I started exploring other departments almost of these portraits, and I remembered the soldiers. You know, I felt like it had already been a number of years since I was a kid that I had really explored the idea of the soldiers. And so this was a diptych titled, "I'm Your Brother from Another Mother." And so there's always this sort of twisted, underlying sense of humor in some of this work, but at the same time, you know, perhaps it's for yours or my own sanity, that these things, that you find some sort of hope in them, that you find some sort of revelation or some sort of doorway to carry on. And so we see these two individuals who have slain each other, and they're realizing, even though they're complete opposites, as opposite as night and day, that they weren't so different after all. Perhaps, like they had been told and convinced by others, that they were enemies, perhaps they were brothers in the end, a little too late, as they sort of reflective of old Italian opera posters, in their last dying breath, they sing to each other, "I'm your brother from another mother." And so at this point, I came home, and I saw my dear friend John Holt, who I grew up with since about the age of 9 or 10. John and I were the best of friends and like brothers, did everything together, you know, spent the summers together running around, playing basketball, looking at girls, talking on the phone. I mean, we were buddies. And when I came home in September of 2009, John had just completed his first tour in Iraq as a combat medic. And I asked John, I told him about the series that I was doing, and he was more than enthused to participate. And he was constantly telling me, "Man, you're so lucky. I wish I could just sit around and draw all day." And then he'd always finish it by saying, "Go get a real job." And I explained to him that I was working on this small series of sort of sketchbook studies in the studio in Los Angeles. And they were supposed to be these snippets of everyday connections for me, a response to just sort of everyday faces, everyday experiences. And it was going to be like an ongoing sketchbook diary. And so John was going to be the first one, but I showed him the images of "I'm Your Brother from Another Mother" and explained it to him, and he liked it. And I said, "So I may take your image, and I'm thinking about doing a war series and continuing it." And he said, "Go for it." And so I had John dress up in full combat gear, and it was a very fascinating thing because I was walking him in his old neighborhood up and down the streets, so there was people watering their lawns, just kind of waving and other old ladies that you could see peeking through the blind, like wondering what's going on, and cars honking and giving him a thumbs up. And we spent all day together. And I photographed him. We went to our old high school, Burbank High School, walked around the yard there and walked back. And then at the end of the day, John and I went for a drink, and it was great. You know, John, I hadn't seen him, even though I hadn't seen him in years, it was one of those rare experiences with rare friends where you pick up right where you left off. And we had a good time, and he was the same old John that I knew. Nothing had changed, except when I asked him over a drink about his experiences as a combat medic, his demeanor completely changed. I saw this veil sort of fall over his face. His personality changed, and I knew that he wasn't the same. He wasn't the same sort of innocent kid that we had all known growing up, which was one of the reasons that he was so liked. And when I left the next day, I went back to Los Angeles, and I created this image about a week later. And I sent it to John, and he immediately responded, damn, who is that good-looking guy? And that was so classic John. He thought he was John Travolta. And these were some of the images that I took of John. And so I thought I would share this with you because you get to see the real sort of direct connection and link of how these images are sort of envisioned and how they give birth to the 2D images, you know, the things that appear on canvas and on paper. And so there's a large painting titled John. And when I was doing the image off and on for about 2 years, you know, it was a very difficult image for me to produce. Not only because I was still trying to find closure with my dear friend, but also because John, the portrait of John, had taken on a larger-than-life personality, a larger-than-life meaning. To me, he sort of became the representation of all Johns, especially today. Originally, this image changed in and out for over 2 years, and I can honestly say that this is the only image in my entire career up to this point that has taken me so long to produce. It was an image that I really fought with. It was an image that I really sort of wasn't sure if I could continue or complete, but I'm glad that I did. And for me, it literally became this sort of universal symbol. It's the narrative of this young man trying to find his way back. Perhaps he's fallen off the path. The fogs of war behind him are about to drown him out and erase him. And then I remembered where I started, this idea of erasure. And for me, it was an extremely strong protest against the erasure of not only the troops in the two ongoing wars, but it was an erasure of the troops that are struggling with PTSD, who are not acknowledged by the Department of Defense as casualties of war, who are not acknowledged as combat-related injuries or deaths by the Pentagon. And I saw it as a very important image to convey, because when the audience, in my head, when the audience views this image, it really sets into mind perhaps a series of questions for the viewer. I think most viewers are going to think the obvious and assume that this is a portrait of a soldier who is in combat, but it's actually quite opposite. I never knew John in combat. I didn't stand by his side in combat, so I have no idea what he was like in combat. To me, this is John here at home. One of the small, subtle, but most important hints at that narrative is the American flag patch. John, as well as other soldiers that I've read, wore a black flag patch in combat, and John chose to wear the red, white, and blue patch when he was here at home. So it's suggestive of this individual fighting here at home. Again, you know, this image or this experience for me was, like for many of us, was a very traumatic experience, something that I will never forget. But nonetheless, it was a way to really give tribute to my friend John. It was really a way for me to once again reflect on where I stand with my role as an artist. And so when John passed away in 2009, by 2010, a few weeks later, I was home in January, moved back to San Antonio, and this was the stuff that immediately spit out of me. This whole series that Lyle saw in the studio titled Excerpts for John. And it was probably one of the most personal series of works that I had created because, again, it was so haunting for me to remember. It was a very surreal morning at Fort Sam. It was like something out of a movie. You know, the skies were gray and weeping. It was continuously raining. It was very somber and very quiet and very cold. And I tried to recreate how I remembered that morning in the series of images. One of the things that I did, for some reason, I'm not even sure, I don't even really remember deciding or thinking ahead of time to do this, but I recorded an entire audio file of that whole procession. And so you hear the rain, you hear the horse hooves from the casket and the carriage, you hear the footsteps, and you hear the weeping. And in the studio, I would play this audio file over and over. And that's how I found the imagery for this set of works, where we find the actual procession, like Stations of the Cross, that I had experimented with before in terms of boxing. But for me, this went beyond that. It becomes a modern day procession. The modern final walkthrough of this person's fate and destiny. Again, whether it be it John or someone else, you know, and that's one thing, again, that I always challenge myself to do is to blur that line between what's personally connected to me and what's invented. And the final arrival home. Now, the idea of soldiers at war, other than mere survival, your instinct is to get home. By nature, animals return home to die. And so this really kind of put it all in place for me. It was something that can be related to by anyone. Again, especially today, but regardless of generation, I think this becomes a very classical, universal experience that we're all familiar with as Americans, as individuals. This image was actually taken and used by Ry Cooder, famous musician who some of you may be familiar with. And Ry and I have been able to work on various projects together. This was a song titled Christmas Time this year. Now, Ry used the image again with no personal connection to John, but rather it was this universal theme of American ideals and Americans at war. He paired up with Flaco Jimenez, local legend here, and it was this very sort of playful, conjunto-sounding, but very devastating song in terms of lyrics. But one of the interesting things that we found when Ry put it out in the world was that nobody would pick it up. Anybody from NPR to CNN to the local radio stations, nobody would touch it because of the lyrics. It was extreme commentary on the boys and girls not being able to come home. It was extreme commentary directly at the politicians. But that was something that I felt connected Ry and I because we were striving to do the same things no matter the consequences or no matter the sort of our own perils of putting this stuff out in the world. A few more of the images from America's Finest, piece titled Requiem, which crippled my hand for about 3 or 4 weeks working in the studio. How I decided to paint or to draw 2,500 feathers, who knows? I mean, I joke with Lyle that in the next life I'm coming back as a complete minimalist. And I'd like to mention also that if you have passed by this flag, many people sort of walked by it assuming that I had just folded a real American flag and placed it there, but it's not that. It's actually hand-drawn on canvas and rendered to look like stitched stars on there. Again, the sort of idea of a black flag in protest. Now, the film that you guys were able to view was something that was born out of the Excerpts for John series. It was something that I envisioned probably about halfway through the Excerpts for John. And I saw it as an extension, almost as a resolution now in color. It was a little bit more, I'd say, revealing of hope. It wasn't as somber and as cold as the renditions of that morning in the carriage pieces. And so for me, this really was the sort of rejoicing of this individual finding peace and finding his way home. But again, keep in mind that that casket, you know, is it could be linked in terms of the endless generations of caskets that have come home throughout whichever war, whatever era. And so he really becomes a universal soldier. And so I actually had this casket built and took it to UT and their film department and did some filming with some very good friends of mine, Jimmy Mendiola and Faith Radel, who worked on the film with me. Now, at this point, Home was my third film project, but I had produced or directed and produced two other previous film projects, but each very similar in approach, each one sort of being based on this idea of home. So this was titled Burn. It was a reflection of 99 ghost portraits appearing in and out of the sky over the city of Los Angeles, everything from homeboys to school principals to LAPD officers. And it was sort of a social experiment for me because I put out an open call on Facebook just to see what would happen, and about 99 individuals showed up. And so the fascinating thing was seeing gangbangers standing right next to city politicians, and they were forced, because I had a small studio, they were forced to interact with each other. And for me, that was a very sort of, that became the art piece in itself. One of the most interesting conversations, just very quickly, was listening to this little crew of homies and, you know, very hardened looking guys, and they were all talking about the best way to keep your hair clean and which products to use, and I thought that was pretty fascinating. One guy said, yeah man, after I come out of the shower I get the blow dryer, you gotta wait 7 minutes exactly and then and then a few months later was commissioned by the Southwest School of Art to come home and do an homage to home. To me, it was really the ultimate love letter titled Recuerdo, which is remembering, and also 99 portraits of these ghosts that have been products of the city. The city remains in full motion, in full color, and the city will always live on. It's the individuals who will come and go as endless products of the city. And so in home, the casket no longer is a casket, but personifies the body. And I'll just breeze through these last few images and we'll move on to the next portion. But in America's Finest, you know, Lyle and I thought it was a really great sort of fusion of the two series because in a nutshell, the epitome of what I've been attempting to do over the past decade or so in my career. It's the idea of the heroes that have come and gone. It's the heroes that have from yesterday. It's the heroes that have come and gone today, and it's the heroes that have come and will come and go tomorrow. And so in this series, we see these individuals that are boxed in, caged in by a tight framing, each one a sort of classic comical stereotype representative of his own color and race and hairstyle, each one labeled, whether it be their social status or ethnicity, their religion, and each one linked by the sacred symbols that lay at their feet, that they protect and give their lives for. So we see, you know, a real clear definition of that. The African-American male, classic stereotype, he's got the fro, he holds the defiant Black Panther fist, Black Power, but he stands on the Black Panther, the image that becomes sacred for him, but that has now been skinned and sold in the stores and commodified. Each one has been stripped of their lineage, of their histories, of their hopes and dreams. His funeral wreath reads "Ni modo," which is sort of Chicano slang for "too bad, so sad," or "oh well." His, instead of "everlast" on his shorts, it reads "neverlast." And so going into these final few images here that are more recent works in the studio, again, this work just gets bigger and bigger. This was a painting that I finished about a year ago now, or not even, actually, maybe half a year, that's now found a permanent home in Los Angeles, but was a large canvas titled Ekpyrosis, which is an ancient Greek term that was used to describe the ancient warriors that were sent out to war before they marched the battlefields. Ekpyrosis is defined as meaning to be born out of chaos and to die by chaos. That hand's really not that big. My hands are just really that small. And sort of this idea of this existential portrait of this young soldier who floats endlessly throughout space, throughout generation, throughout civilizations, born out of the same settings and finds destiny in the same results of war. And we'll end right here with a recent image titled "War is Over," and in small print underneath reads "Just Kidding." The actual title is "Thanks Anyway, John and Yoko." Some of you may be familiar with the image, but in 1971, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, one of the most brilliant art projects I thought they ever did was they borrowed from the V-Day papers, Victory, after the end of World War II, that read "War is Over." And they took that and titled it "War is Over," and in fine print underneath read, stated, "If you want it," and put it out in every major American billboard, on buildings in Times Square, anywhere they could find, because they felt that the idea of the housewife, someone that would read images throughout advertising and television on a daily basis, that was their target, you know, seeping into the minds of housewives. And they were quoted as saying, plus it was going to be women that brought peace first before men ever did. Thank you.